Abbas al-Amud. In an exchange caught on camera, King mocked Palestinian activist Muhammad Abu Hummus for being shot by Israeli regime forces in his backside and then pointing at his head, said, "It's a pity it didn't go in here." The impending removal of Palestinian families from Sheikh Jarrah fueled tensions in Al-Quds, which spiraled out of the Holy City into Gaza and the rest of Palestine. The Zionist regime airstrikes are now blanketing Gaza. King is one of the players, among others, who has stoked tensions in Sheikh Jarrah, the site of a long simmering crisis. In 2007, King started the group Israel Land Fund. The Israel Land Fund isn't trying to dominate East Al-Quds by itself. It's doing it with the help of private American donors who get tax deductions for the money they give to U.S.-based nonprofits who funnel the money into Israeli settlements. The overwhelming majority of the Israel Land Fund's budget comes from the Central Fund of Israel, a U.S.-based nonprofit. The Central Fund of Israel is among a network of U.S.-based groups fueling dispossession and displacement of Palestinians from neighborhoods in Al-Quds to make way for Jewish settlers. The group's tax-exempt nonprofit status means their donors receive an effective U.S. government subsidy to bolster the settlement movement. From 2009 to 2013, U.S. charities funneled over $220 million to Israeli settler organizations. According to a 2015 Haaretz investigation, U.S. nonprofit central involvement in the Israeli settler movement has sparked calls among Palestinian rights advocates for the U.S. government to investigate the U.S.-based organizations fueling Palestinian displacement. Reached by phone, on the number listed on the Central Fund of Israel's website, a man who refused to give his name declined to comment on the group's activities, saying, "My history with journalists has been so horrible, I'm not interested." An Israel Land Fund spokesperson said, "ILF is not involved in any illegal act." The spokesperson told The Intercept that the group is not involved so much in Sheikh Jarrah. The Israel Land Fund assisted in the eviction of a Palestinian family in Sheikh Jarrah in 2017, and King openly advertises that one of his major targets is the neighborhood. "In about 10 years, we will have in Sheikh Jarrah some 400, maybe 500 Jewish families," King told the Jerusalem Post in 2017. The Israel Land Fund advertises residential plots in what the group calls Nahalot Shimon, the Hebrew name given to parts of Sheikh Jarrah. Two other Al-Quds neighborhoods, Batan al-Hawa and al-Bustan, are also facing a wave of eviction orders instigated by U.S. nonprofit-backed settler groups. The Sheikh Jarrah and al-Bustan eviction plans, which threaten the homes of some 2,000 Palestinians, were condemned as violations of international law by 25 House Democrats in a letter sent to Secretary of State Antony Blinken recently, calling on the State Department to pressure the Zionist regime over the pending forced displacement. The organization behind the targeting of 8 Palestinian families in Sheikh Jarrah is a U.S.-registered real estate firm by the name of Nahalot Shimon. Though the Israel Land Fund is not linked to the current round of evictions, King is loudly advocating for it because it will help his dream of turning Sheikh Jarrah into a Palestinian-free, Jewish-only settlement. In 2017, King's organization helped evict 8 members of the Shemansne family from their home in Sheikh Jarrah. The Israel Land Fund contacted the era what the courts said were the original Jewish owners and represented her in legal proceedings to kick the family out. The Central Fund of Israel, the main funder of King's Group, is a New York registered nonprofit run by Jay Marcus, the owner of a textile company that takes in millions of dollars every year from donors who get to write off the checks as tax deductions. Since 2011, the CFI has given the Israel Land Fund over $720,000 for its settlement activities, according to documents filed to Israeli regulators and reviewed by The Intercept. In 2017, the Central Fund of Israel's donation constituted 99.2% of the Israel Land Fund's total budget. Such arrangements between U.S. nonprofit groups and Israeli settler organizations are not uncommon. 2 miles to the south of Sheikh Jarrah lie the Silwa neighborhoods of Batan al-Halwa and al-Bustan, which are both in the crosshairs of Israeli settlers. In November 2020, an Israeli court ruled in favor of Israeli settler group Ataret Kohanim's request to displace 87 Palestinians from their homes in Batan al-Halwa. Ataret Kohanim is backed by the U.S.-based American Friends of Ataret Kohanim, which delivers tax-deductible donations to the settler group. According to the site Charity Navigator, which tracks such groups, in September 2020, the Internal Revenue Service automatically revoked the American Friends tax-exempt status because the group failed to file documents with the U.S. government. In 2017, the last year records are available. The group gave its settler counterparts over $525,000. And in Al-Bustan, 88 Palestinian homes are facing demolition orders to make way for archaeological attractions meant to showcase the ancient Jewish link to the area. The group instigating the demolitions is Elad, an Israeli settler group, which in turn is funded in part by Friends of Er David, a U.S.-based nonprofit. Friends of Er David gave $36 million to the Israeli group between 2006 to 2013, according to Haaretz. They depend on their donors' money, said Hagit Ofran, the director of Israeli group Peace Now Settlement Watch. Without the donors, there is no settlement in East Al-Quds. The leading role U.S. charities play in displacement of Palestinians has prompted Palestinian rights advocates to call for increased scrutiny of the nonprofits.
On May 15, 1948, the regime forced some 750,000 Palestinians to leave their homes and villages and expelled them into refugee camps that still exist in the occupied West Bank, Gaza, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. Armed forces massacred entire villages of men, women, and even children. That pushed rightful owners of Palestine to leave their homes and lands as they feared losing their lives. Consequently, that provided the ground for Zionists to establish the Israeli regime. The Palestinians were to suffer further when the West Bank and Gaza fell to the Israelis during the Six-Day War in 1967. Millions of Palestinians, including those displaced since 1948, found themselves under military occupation as well as further Israeli expansionism in their lands. In 2020, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu unveiled his intention to annex the occupied West Bank with the support of the United States. The move is widely condemned as it is considered illegal and in defiance of international law. For many Palestinians, that is just the last chapter in a process that has started with the initial loss of their lands in 1948. More than 600,000 Israelis currently live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the West Bank and East Jerusalem Al-Quds. That's while all Israeli settlement activities are illegal under international law. Every year, Palestinians reaffirm their right to return to their homes and villages in historic Palestine on Nakba Day. They hold annual rallies to commemorate decades of ethnic cleansing of their homeland by the regime to establish what's known today as Israel. This year, Palestinians and their supporters across the globe mark the day amid Israel's deadly aggression against Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip.
The Israeli government is taking more lands in the West Bank. More than two-thirds of the West Bank has been swallowed by the Israeli settlements. And every day they are also taking more lands in Jerusalem. As we have seen in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, they are kicking Palestinians out of their hands, of their homes and lands in order to replace them with Israeli, with Jewish settlers. It will continue because the Palestinians are not willing to surrender to the Israeli to the Israeli policies of ethnic cleansing.
In a pre-dawn airstrike, Israeli warplanes attacked Al-Shati refugee camp in western Gaza on Saturday. 8 children and 2 women were killed while 15 others were injured. Following that, Hamas's military wing, the Ezzedine al-Qassam Brigades, said it has fired tens of rockets at Tel Aviv and Ashdod in retaliation for Israel's attacks on the Gaza Strip. The Ezzedine al-Qassam Brigades also said they launched drone and mortar attacks on Israel's Kisafim military base. The group has announced it is prepared to bomb Tel Aviv for 6 months in a row. Hamas has recently stepped up attacks on Israel in response to the regime's aggression on the besieged territory. Israel's Ramon Airport, as well as cities of Ashkelon and Ashdod, have also come under missile attacks in the past few days. On Saturday afternoon, the Israeli regime also flattened the 11-story Al Jalla building that housed the offices of Al Jazeera and the Associated Press News Agency. Press freedom advocates sharply condemned the move, calling it a brazen attempt to silence journalists covering the Israeli military's ongoing offensive that has killed scores of people.
They will continue to do so because they are launching a war against not only the Palestinian people but also against the media that is showing the real Israeli face and real Israeli violations of human rights.
Targeting the media organizations and journalists in Israeli military offensives in the Gaza Strip isn't an accident. This is systematic targeting of media in Gaza in order to prevent reporting from there and to create a cloak of secrecy around Israeli crimes.
Gaza and the other Palestinian territories have been simmering with anger over Israel's stepped-up land-grab policies in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds, as well as the regime's desecration of the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex, one of the holiest sites in Islam. Days after the regime launched a heavy-handed crackdown on Palestinian worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque during the holy fasting month of Ramadan, tensions spiraled into a broader conflict between Gaza and Israel. Since last Monday, the Israeli military has been launching large-scale airstrikes against Gaza, razing many homes and civilian infrastructure to the ground. The regime's artillery and tanks have also been targeting the blockaded coastal enclave, killing and injuring scores of people, including women and children. Meanwhile, the Palestinian resistance groups have been responding to Israel's acts of aggression with massive barrages of rockets and missiles. They have also brought drones into the equation. Much to Israel's surprise, rocket launches have largely overwhelmed the regime's anti-missile system, dubbed the Iron Dome, and hit several cities across the occupied territories, leaving several dead and dozens of others injured.
So, of course, the Zionists have always believed that they have been protected behind what they called an Iron Dome, that missile defense shield that they believed would defend them from all attacks either from Palestinian resistance forces or from the wider Arab and Islamic world, such as Syria, Lebanon, and Iran. Now, we have seen, of course, that this Iron Dome is more like an iron sieve nowadays, because the amount of missiles, hundreds and hundreds of missiles that have gotten through and have landed, some of them in strategic places such as cities near the Gaza Strip or near Ben Gurion Airport in the occupied in Zionist city of Tel Aviv.
Meanwhile, the regime in Tel Aviv has been under criticism worldwide, with many supporters of the Palestinian cause in Muslim countries and elsewhere holding rallies in solidarity with the Palestinians. As the exchange of fire between the Israeli army and the resistance groups continue, the tensions in the occupied West Bank has reached a fever pitch. So far, several incidents have been recorded where mobs of settlers raided and vandalized Palestinian shops or attacked Palestinian Arabs there.
They are so high up in the clouds, let's say, of their own superiority, of their own master race status, let's say, in the region, that they don't really believe in the possibility of resistance in the region really making a dent in the Zionist armor. And what we have seen now is that there is way more than a dent in the armor. The Palestinians have broken through this armor.
While the Israeli attacks on Palestinians have been met with international condemnation, the United States has stopped short of denouncing the regime's crimes. Washington blocked a UN Security Council meeting on the Palestinian situation and prevented the world body from releasing a statement on the issue, saying that such a move would not be helpful to de-escalation talks with the two sides. Washington's support for the regime has sparked an outcry inside the United States, too. Several Democratic members of the U.S. Congress have lashed out at the regime and slammed the United States' unconditional support for it.
We must condition aid to Israel on compliance with international human rights and end the apartheid. We must, with no hesitation, demand that our country recognize the unconditional support of Israel has enabled the erasure of Palestinian life and the denial of the rights of millions of refugees.
As Israel ramps up its attacks on the people of Palestine, such calls for its boycott are growing stronger. But how many more lives should be lost before the voices are heard?
Iran and the remaining signatories to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action are continuing their talks in Vienna to save the nuclear agreement nearly 3 years after Washington's unilateral withdrawal in 2018. The United States is complicating the negotiations by insisting on keeping in place 500 anti-Iran sanctions, including in the 2015 nuclear deal, officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. Informed sources say if kept in place, the sanctions on these 500 individuals and entities will prevent Iran from doing business with the rest of the world, which is in violation of Article 29 of the agreement. This is while Tehran has time and again reiterated that Washington has to take the first step towards reviving the nuclear deal by unconditionally removing all sanctions in a verifiable manner.
It has been the United States who left the JCPOA, who withdrew from the JCPOA. It is the United States who should come first, who should implement its obligations and lift all of its sanctions. And then Iran would verify, and after open verification, Iran would restart its obligations in the JCPOA.
Tehran has also reiterated its calls that the United States has to remove not some, but all sanctions on the Islamic Republic.
Well, our position is quite clear. All sanctions should be lifted. All sanctions which are mentioned in the JCPOA, and any new sanctions imposed after the adoption day of the JCPOA, including everything during Trump administration. This is our position, it's quite clear, and we are working to come to a conclusion which, you know, meet our demands on the sanctions lifting area.
The comments by Araghchi comes as the JCPOA has been in disarray since May 2018 when former U.S. President Donald Trump abandoned the deal and reimposed the anti-Iran sanctions that the JCPOA had removed. The Trump administration has also placed additional sanctions on Iran under other pretexts not related to Iran's nuclear energy program as part of its maximum pressure campaign. The negotiations in Vienna come as the new U.S. administration has expressed readiness to compensate for Trump's mistake and rejoin the deal. It is, however, showing an overriding willingness to maintain some of the sanctions as a tool of pressure. Many believe that the U.S. refusal to remove anti-Iran sanctions would mean the talks are about to fail or have already failed.
I think that we are in a very important situation right now. We will know in the coming days whether the talks will succeed or in fact fail. And the pressure is currently on Washington, because while the Iranian government stands firmly together in their refusal to renegotiate agreements that have been in the works for years now, the American side is completely disorganized, and it's not sure whether President Biden will remain the majority leader in both houses of Congress for the foreseeable future.
Some also believe that there is a possibility that the U.S. will resort to the old tactic of agreeing to a nuclear deal with all of its benefits on paper, yet intimidate other countries from doing business with Iran using the threat of sanctions like it did during the 2015 nuclear agreement. Iran says it will not allow the negotiations to become attritional. Iran's top negotiator in Vienna and Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi says the Islamic Republic would stop the negotiations if it concludes that the other side lacks seriousness, tries to buy time, or seek to add new topics to those under discussion. Iran says the ball is now in the U.S.'s court to return to the agreement and remove all sanctions on Tehran or pursue the failed policy of its predecessor known as Maximum Pressure Campaign and push ahead with its hostile policy against the Islamic Republic. The Biden administration has so far not taken any solid measure to return to the deal over 100 days after it took the helm in Washington. The next 2 weeks will be decisive, and the negotiations could go either way. More attacks by Israeli forces against Palestinians in the occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds. On Monday, over 300 Palestinians were wounded after Israeli troops fired rubber bullets on them around the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Scores were detained by Israeli forces. The protests erupted after Israeli troops stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in an effort to force out the Palestinians. The violence around the mosque and the Old City were the worst since 2017, fueled by a years-long bid by Israeli settlers to take over Palestinian homes in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. The Israeli regime is also celebrating its 1967 occupation of Jerusalem al-Quds.
There are several facts here. One is that this is a process of, once again, of ethnic cleansing in broad daylight. It is a provocation, obvious provocation against Islam, and has appropriately been denounced by most Arab countries, including a couple of them who are overly anxious to normalize relations with Israel and hopefully will now reconsider what they've done.
Sheikh Ikrima Sabri, the imam and preacher of Al-Aqsa Mosque, has condemned the attack, calling the raid a heinous crime that cannot be tolerated. Leader of the Palestinian National Initiative Party, Mustafa Barghouti, called the Israeli raid on Al-Aqsa Mosque compound a criminal act. Barghouti described the raid as a racist act by an apartheid regime.
Well, Israel is indisputably an apartheid state. It always has been from the outset. From 1948 on, it simply wasn't called that. The apartheid nature of Israel was confirmed in 1967 when it invaded the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem. Mustafa Barghouti is absolutely 100% right when he calls it a criminal act.
The military brigade of the Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, also warned against the presence of Israeli forces in the Al-Aqsa Mosque. The situation is so fluid, and resistance movements fired tens of rockets toward occupied Palestine Monday afternoon. The clashes in Al-Aqsa Mosque have drawn widespread condemnation from the international community. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres urged Israel to cease demolitions and evictions, saying Israeli authorities must exercise maximum restraint. The U.S. government, however, stopped short of condemning the Israeli aggression against Palestinians. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan instead conveyed serious concern to his Israeli counterpart about violent confrontations in Jerusalem al-Quds. Arab nations, including Syria, Iraq, and Qatar, also hit out at Israel over the Jerusalem violence. Some Arab countries, including those that last year normalized relations with Israel, condemned the Israeli aggression. Iran, Pakistan, and many other nations also slammed the attack. In Britain, Germany, Turkey, Jordan, and elsewhere, people took to the streets to condemn the Israeli regime's atrocities and voice solidarity with the Palestinian people. In some countries like Oman, people gathered in front of the Israeli embassy to condemn the raids.
It's clear, I think, to the peoples of the world, even if it's not necessarily to political classes in the Occident, in the West, that the Israeli regime is a criminal entity, and what they're seeing. Practiced against the Palestinian people, Palestinian worshippers, which is really the reflection of a process that's gone on for far too long and backed by Western governments, specifically Washington and its allies. So there's no surprise in the fact that people everywhere in the world are outraged.
The Israeli desecration of the Al-Aqsa Mosque is nothing new. Israel has done similar acts in the past many times. Tel Aviv has been violating the rights of Palestinians with impunity since its installment in the region by its Western creators. The regime enjoys full support from the U.S. in particular.
The reason that Israel was created in the first place was that it was meant to be a foothold for British expansion into the region, and to the control of oil and gas, natural gas resources in the region.
What is clear is the fact that the Israeli aggression against Palestinians cannot end through dialogue. Israel has defied calls to stop violating the rights of Palestinians for decades. Many factions in Palestine have also come to the conclusion that Israel can be pushed back only through resistance, and that any effort short of resistance will come to nothing given Washington's all-out support for the Israeli regime at the UN Security Council, the only world body that can issue a binding resolution against the regime.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini Islam, Dini, and one of them, Ghairu Dini, Muhammad Illi Hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Going to talk about some of the laws of miscellaneous nature according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Sistani. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzumah Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazvini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in Fiqh and Usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Javid, in some countries, there are some codes of conducts in different firms and companies. For example, bankers should wear suits.
Yeah.
All right. Sometimes there are some laws against bearded men.
Yes.
All right. And they have to have a clean shave.
Right.
When this becomes that inevitable, all right, that the men should shave off their beard. And we all know that according to Ayatollah Sistani, as you mentioned and explained in the last episode or the previous episode, that shaving is haram four men.
As an obligatory precaution.
As an obligatory precaution, yes.
Yes.
So when this, imagine this scenario, and what is the Islamic law about this situation or this scenario?
That's also a good question, because, of course, there are some scenarios, as you rightly mentioned. There are, for example, men and nurses, and they are, they work, or there are doctors working in a hospital. They carry out surgical operations, and they are required not to have beard. There are also some companies requiring their employees to clean shave, okay, otherwise they will not be allowed to work. Okay, Ayatollah Sistani says that if it becomes a cause of ridicule, okay, and if it becomes a cause of trouble and problem which is generally not bearable, okay, a problem which is difficult to bear, like, for example, if you lose your job, okay, you lose your job, and then you will have no job to do for a month or for 2 months. You will be looking here and there for a job, but you, no one is giving you a job because of the beard. Mm-hmm. In that case, you can shave your beard.
Right.
And basically, Ayatollah Sistani does not have a fatwa in regard to beard. He says that shaving beard is not permissible as an obligatory precaution. So in such a case, if there is a mujtahid, let's say there's a mujtahid who is the next most learned mujtahid, one can refer to him,
mm-hmm,
and follow him if he has a fatwa allowing shaving beard. Okay. Then there are also other alternatives. For example, it's not necessary to, according to some religious authorities, not according to Ayatollah Sistani, to have full beard. Okay, a French cut beard is sufficient, according to many religious authorities.
Right.
So many companies do not object to the French cut beard. Mm-hmm. Okay, they think, okay, it's a style of beard.
Right.
It's a style, it's acceptable. So one can suffice to the French cut beard following one of the religious authorities who allow the French cut beard. Okay, if a person remains a muqallid, even in this case, a muqallid of Ayatollah Sistani, then in that particular scenario, when it becomes difficult, when it becomes a cause of contempt, a cause of ridicule, he can shave his beard. Otherwise, it's not permissible as a measure of obligatory precaution.
Even in scenarios where you're going to be ridiculed?
That's it, yes, of course.
Uh-huh, I see. What about patients? Because we all know that if there is going to be an operation, that part of the body,
yeah,
the skin should be without any hair.
Yeah.
So they shave it before any kind of surgery, all right?
Yeah.
And if it happens that the operation is going to be, in fact, on the face.
Yes.
And then there should be a shave, a clean shave there.
Sure.
Does this law apply to that too?
Definitely, of course, because shaving, a person does not want to have a surgical operation on his jaws or let's say on his face, unless there is a need requiring such an operation. Okay, and of course that is more important to have your jaw in perfect condition is, mm-hmm, more important than to maintain your beard.
I see.
So shaving beard is permissible in that case.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.ayatollahsistani.com. sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
Would you tell us and shed more light on a standard view of having a beard according to Islamic laws? What's the minimum and maximum beard?
Okay. The minimum beard is the beard in which is considered according to common view as beard, okay?
Right.
Now, if someone looks at your face and considers you as a bearded person, that's sufficient. Even if the beard is very short, that does not matter. As long as you are considered to be bearded, as long as someone tells you that you have a beard, that is sufficient. Clean shave is forbidden, but okay, trimming your beard is permissible. To cut your beard short is permissible. As for the maximum size of the beard is concerned, of course, according to riwayat, according to ahadith, it is makruh to have a beard longer than the width of a fist.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, longer than the width of a fist. So it is permissible to have a long beard, but it's makruh. It's let's say reprehensible to have such a long beard that it will exceed the width of your fist.
Regarding the minimum definition of having a standard beard according to Islamic laws, we all know that it varies from culture to culture. If you go to Afghanistan, I guess a stubble is not considered a kind of beard, right? But if you go to the West, I think a stubble is too much beard, isn't it?
Yeah.
So what do you say? Because you said in an answer to the question previously, you said it all depends on the culture and the common view.
If the common view
looks at it as a beard or recognizes it as a beard, then it's a beard.
You're right. You know, everyone should look at the common view prevalent in his own town, okay, in his own locality, okay. You are not going to go to Africa and ask whether it's called beard or not. You're not going to some other countries. You should ask the mu'minin, the believers in your own city, okay, because the custom differs from one town to another town, from one place to another place, okay? For example, in some places, beating drums is considered to be offensive in the month of, in the month of Muharram, okay? But beating drums in Iran, for example, is very common and it's acceptable. The religious authorities have allowed it, okay?
And they also do it in morning ceremonies.
In morning ceremonies. But in places like, let's say, Afghanistan, beating drums seems to be a sign of expressing joy and happiness, and it's so offensive, so one should not start beating drums, okay?
Mm-hmm.
In those places where it is considered offensive. The same is true with keeping a beard, and one should consult the mu'minin, not ordinary individual who do not seem to be very much abiding or practicing Muslims, okay?
Mm-hmm.
One should consult practicing Muslims. One should follow their opinions when it comes to the size of the beard, the minimum size, and the minimum size, because we are not talking about the maximum size. The maximum size, there's no limit. One can keep long beard even if it exceeds the width of the beard, but it becomes makruh, it becomes reprehensible, and it's better according to riwayat, according to ahadith, to not to keep a beard which exceeds the width of a fist.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahmanun rahimun mannanun kareemun salamun alimun la ilaha illahum ghaffarun jameelun wahhabun latifun tawwabun samiun barakatuh.
Peruvian zoo has shown off two baby crocodiles that were born through artificial insemination. The Huachipa Zoo in Lima celebrated their birth 3 months ago. Zookeepers say the two crocs are in good health. The American crocodiles now weigh around 70 grams each and measure 26 centimeters in length. However, it's too early to determine the gender of the newborns. American crocodile is in danger of extinction due to pollution and habitat loss. What was once an underground movement is now all the buzz. After a 17-year hiatus, billions of red-eyed cicadas, are crawling their way above ground in the United States. These cicadas are known as broodics, and they are beginning to emerge from the depths of the earth in a dramatic fashion. These bugs have been sighted in 15 eastern states of America. They're around 4 centimeters in length with unforgettable bright red eyes and iridescent wings. Experts say these insects do not hibernate. In fact, they grow slowly underground for 17 years before they emerge to mate.
There are several misconceptions about periodical cicadas. One is that they're locusts. They're not locusts. Locusts are grasshoppers. Cicadas are much more closely related to aphids. There's another misconception that cicadas are harmful. Cicadas are not harmful. They don't bite. They don't sting. They're not going to harm you or your pets, so you don't have to fear the cicada.
Michael Robb says cicadas tend to thrive on the edges of sunlit forests where it's warmer. They live above ground as adults for about 3 weeks, long enough to reproduce before dying. They lay eggs inside young tree branches, which hatch a few weeks later to restart the cycle. This year's cicada class will bore into the ground and won't emerge until 2038. Paris's Disneyland welcomes back the Magic and it has officially announced its reopening on the 17th of June. The famous theme park is currently in its second closure since the COVID-19 outbreak, being shut for nearly 8 months. With over 17,000 employees, Disneyland Paris cancelled its reopening plans twice because of the ongoing pandemic. But now, as France has eased its COVID-19 restrictions and tourist sites are gradually resuming their operations, the park has released a date to open its gates again. The reopening of Disneyland Paris will be the first time all six Disney resorts have been open since January 2020, when Shanghai Disneyland first closed due to COVID-19. A French musician has come up with an innovative idea to end his pandemic hiatus, performing on top of a mountain in Swiss Alps. Tiho performed on a platform at an altitude of 3,000 meters. The 30-year-old artist braved sub-zero temperatures in April to perform. He also had to overcome his fear of heights. Tiho has not performed in public for more than a year due to COVID-19 restrictions. He says the lockdown offers him a good chance to become more creative.
I feel like I had a lot of creativity during this period because I was stuck in the studio and a lot of time to make music. So Usually when I I perform gigs and I don't have so much time to spend in studio, so today during these days is like better.
A music production company organized the show. The small platform was taken up to the resort by helicopter. It took 4 hours to install the setting. A Chinese version of the Titanic has been created to keep alive memories of the ship over a century after its ill-fated maiden voyage. The full-scale replica will soon be open to the public. It's part of a theme park in Sichuan Province, southwest of China. The construction work started 6 years ago, involving over 100 workers. Around 23,000 tons of steel has been used to build the ship. That's 260 meters long. Designers hope that it will attract up to 5 million visitors a year.
The ship is located in the west part of China. It will attract tourists from the world. We estimate that the number of visitors will be between 2 million to 5 million in a year. This tourist volume should guarantee the return of our investment.
Everything in the duplication, from cabins to doorknobs, is identical to the organic Titanic, that is, original Titanic. Spending one night on the five-star ship cost around $150. The original luxury vessel sank in April 1912 after hitting an iceberg. Over 1,500 people died in the accident.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Animals living in the Paris Zoological Park will soon be able to see visitors again after months of just interacting with zookeepers due to COVID-19 restrictions. The zoo is preparing to reopen next week with limited numbers of visitors and obligatory health protocols. During the shutdown, the park welcomed over 60 new babies, including baboons, penguins, and flamingos. Experts believe the reopening will reawaken animals' curiosity.
Seeing public again will reawaken the animals' curiosity. They also look at the visitors. Some are very interested. You'll see the seals when they're with small children. It's part of enriching their environment to see a little bit of people, of diversity. So it's good for everyone.
The park, which temporarily closed last October, houses 2,500 animals of 234 species. France is now easing its COVID-19 restrictions and plans to reopen museums, zoos, shops, and cinemas on May the 19th. Looking for a cheaper and more sustainable alternative to traditional lawn mowers? Chip may be the answer. Researchers at the University of California, Davis, have embarked on a project to test the effectiveness of sheep as new lawn mowers. The project includes 25 sheep of 4 different breeds. They are going to graze on a 1-acre plot of pasture for 3 days. The process will be repeated after a month.
The sheep have been used for a couple of things. So they're as good as goats in reducing down the vegetation. So in areas where there is, it doesn't just have to be a lawn. If they're in their areas where there's overgrown and you've got sort of those higher fuel ladders, they can eat that down. But what they also do, so they can cut that out, but then they also can come around and after there's been a fire, they're really good at eating the weeds that come up initially, the weeds that we don't want, those invasive weeds.
Researchers believe that the initiative also has an environmental impact. With fewer mowers, there might be less emission. They also hope using sheep will help increase natural fertilization and nutrient levels.
using unusual array of tools for a haircut. That's what a Pakistani barber does to rise above the competition. Ali Abbas lives in the city of Lahore, eastern Pakistan. He uses blowtorches, meat cleavers, and even broken glass to do a cut. He typically begins a haircut with a blowtorch to take a bit off the top. He then uses a cleaver and butcher's block and sometimes broken glass to cut the lower layers. His style is proving to be a hit.
This idea was not a joke. One day I was thinking of doing something different. It was my desire to do something in a different way. Since I started this, my customers have increased. People's confidence has been boosted. When you're visible on a platform and people see you, people will say, we must try this, we should try this.
Abbas has been using this style since 2016. He says he has received a very good response from his clients. His peculiar approach has also resulted in TV appearances and fashion shoots. It's not an everyday scene for Londoners to see a whale swimming in the River Thames, but over the weekend, the city witnessed a small whale being rescued after it got stuck along the river. The baby whale was first spotted in the evening, becoming stranded on the Lock's boat rollers in Richmond. Rescuers worked during the night to free the 4-meter-long whale. After 4 hours, the injured animal was successfully moved to a safer location. A vet is now monitoring its situation to make sure it's healthy enough to be released back to the ocean.
People around the world dream of having special weddings, but these couples in Russia have made their wishes come true. 30 couples in Moscow have gotten married on cable car cabins, hoping to set a world record. The sweethearts exchanged vows mid-air with a picturesque view of rainy Moscow. If the attempt to set a record is verified and confirmed, it will go to the Guinness Book of World Records. The wedding ceremony in Russia has turned into an extraordinary one as it was celebrated on a 720-meter-long cable car. 30 Russian couples tied the knot in the moving cable car cabins on Saturday. Even rainy weather in Moscow didn't stop them. The newlyweds said they wanted to make their already special day as unusual as possible. They also hope that their mass wedding would set a Guinness World Record. The remains of 9 Neanderthals have been found near the Italian capital, Rome. Archaeologists believe the oldest one is dated to around 100,000 years ago. The other 8 remains are dated between 50,000 and 68,000 years ago. Researchers unearthed the fossil fragments in the Guattari prehistoric cave, or caves, I should say, near Rome. Neanderthals are the closest ancient relatives of humans. They died out about 40,000 years ago. Some theories say they died because of their inability to adapt to climate change.
IRIB English Radio.